Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. In the final days of World War II, an American soldier found a Japanese sword on an Okinawa beach. It bore a tag with a request, one that long went unanswered. 80 years later, he and his grandson, Kevin Krause, set off in search of the blade's owner. And the tag on the sword said, "I'm very glad to have the honor to ask your favor to send my sword to my home. This sword, as I am told, has been handed down from generation to generation to keep my family safe and comfortable, remembering your kindness." The sword was suspended in the basement rafters with a message from 1945 still secured to its fittings. My grandfather and I were sitting one floor above it at his kitchen table when an email arrived. It was 9:17 a.m. on Christmas Day in 2021. The Chicago weather too mild, the ground too much of a defeated brown, and the gathering too small to suggest that anything festive was about to happen. A notification lit up my phone with the subject line, "Merry Christmas," and a letter from Umeki-san. The timing was convenient. I was visiting for the holidays, staying at my mother's childhood home in Franklin Park, 10 miles west of Chicago. My parents were there too. My grandfather, Joseph Kasser, who goes by Ben or Benny, built a home in 1957 for a family of four that eventually dwindled to one. My mom, Kathy, was the first to go, leaving for college in 1971. My grandma, Alice, died in 2008. My uncle, Bob, died in 2010. They left Benny alone on Lewis Street with a lifetime of modest possessions. Among them was a Japanese sword he found on an Okinawa beach in the final days of World War II. It was 6 months after I first asked Benny if he'd be interested in finding the sword's owner. I don't remember what I said to start the conversation. I do remember that I was nervous asking a man who doesn't owe much to part ways with a keepsake he'd found during the perhaps the most consequential time of his life as an anti-aircraft gunner in the U.S. Army. He didn't hesitate. He said, "Sure." It was one of those inspired "sures" that really means absolutely, a posture correcting "sure," an energy in tone "sure," not "I suppose" or "if you want," a momentous syllable that set something off. It was apparently something he had considered. Now, Christmas Day, I didn't know if the email that had arrived contained good news about our quest. I read it silently while sitting at the kitchen table, where I heard one side of the story for more than 3 decades. As kids, my brothers and I wanted to see the sword, and we wanted to hear Benny's World War II stories. One of those stories was set aboard a troop ship in the East China Sea at the start of the invasion of Okinawa. Japanese plane was descending towards the ship as my grandfather and other American soldiers watched from the deck. The plane was wounded, smoking and burning, he told us, panning his hand toward the kitchen table like a plane. Our Navy guys were shooting at them, and it was coming down like this, wobbling and smoking. Pretty soon the shells started coming down and dropping like hail. If that plane would have landed on the deck, it would have exploded, firing gas, we would have all been gone. Instead, it crashed into the sea. Those are sounds, images, and feelings Benny never forgot. And the word kamikaze, referring to a Japanese pilot using his plane and life as a weapon, became more familiar to him than any other in the Japanese language. His training was an artilleryman, and he prepared to ship out to the European theater to shoot 155mm shells in ground combat. But the late war threat in Japan changed his course, and he headed to the Western Pacific as part of the anti-aircraft unit with the Army's 77th Infantry Division. He left Hawaii on January 30, 1945, and stopped in the Philippines before a ship carried him to the Battle of Okinawa. His ship situated itself in the East China Sea on March 26, among some 1,400 Allied vessels stretching to the horizon, staged for an invasion that would begin 6 days later. Shortly after the battle commenced, 21-year-old Benny was ordered from the ship onto a landing craft and carried to the main island of Okinawa. The front of the craft flung open, and he made his way through the shallow water to the uncontested beach, one of the battle's roughly 182,000 U.S. soldiers. His anti-aircraft duties kept him out of the frontline combat, and for the duration of the battle, he remained on mainland Okinawa, the nearby islands of Aijima. Japanese resistance on Okinawa fell in June, but the war carried on. He stayed there late into the summer as Japanese surrender started to take shape. Growing up, was taught a simplified version of World War II history, in which Japanese soldiers refused to surrender, even if the alternative was certain death. But in Okinawa, Benny saw Japanese prisoners who had laid down their arms to save their own lives. He knew that if he were in their position, he'd do the same. He saw that as sensible, not weak. The war ended on September 2nd with Japan's formal surrender. On Okinawa, while waiting orders for his first post-war transfer, Benny came across a scattering of abandoned weapons near the coast. He stepped over rifles and swords encased in military-issue fittings, all looking vaguely the same. In its scabbard, the sword that caught his eye seemed no more remarkable, but there was something unexpected attached to it. A tag. He picked up the weapon and took it with him when he left Okinawa for Korea on September 15th. Upon arrival in Incheon, he shipped the sword to his parents and hoped he'd soon follow. He didn't think he'd see it again, but the handlers of the Army Post Office and U.S. Postal Service got it from the Korean Peninsula to Illinois in late 1945. When Benny came home, he picked up the sword at his parents' farm and moved with it to an apartment before he built the home I'd come to know. There, it occasionally emerged from my grandparents' basement and into the kitchen, with too many of us gathered around their three-seat table. Benny was modest and quiet, while my grandmother and elder brother, Eric, nudged him towards the memories. If he complied, Benny began saying how easy he had it compared with the frontline infantry. We were left with an image of him finding the sword. We didn't consider a next step. When the stories of our grandfather as a younger man were over, the silent blade went back into the cool basement on Lewis Street. He didn't display it. It wasn't a trophy. Eventually, he stopped telling people about it. He'd grown tired of answering the same irritating question. Did you kill him? The message attached to the sword was a surrender tag. On one side of the wooden tag slab, its Japanese owner had inked in perfect British English, "I'm very glad to have the honor to ask your favor to send my sword to my home. This sword, as I am told, has been handed down from generation to generation to keep my family safe and comfortable, remembering your kindness. Colonel Tomoseki Umeki, Takaharu Machi, Nishi Morokata County, Miyazaki Prefecture, Takaharu Station, Yoshita Line." Takaharu is a town on the Kyushu, the southernmost of Japan's four main islands, west of Takaharu. Mount Takashiho emerges from the green hills of the volcanic Kirishima Kinkawen National Park. The mountain is a significant landmark in Shinto mythology because Naningi, the grandson of the Sun goddess Amaterasu, is said to have descended there to become the first ruler of Japan, establishing the divinity of all emperors thereafter. Naningi brought with him three objects, a mirror, a jewel, and a sword. Sacred objects that to this day are the imperial regalia of Japan, symbolizing the emperor's connection to the divine. In Shinto belief, spirits, kami, are not only connected to the shrines constructed in their honor, but also linked to objects, landscapes, and other earthly phenomena. It's also believed that the deceased can become kami with certain ancestral heirlooms, serving as a tether. Families that own swords may pass them down through generations with such ancestral connections in mind. Tomosuku had created the surrender tag, petitioned the finder of a centuries-old katana about what to do with it, and sent the sword into the wind, kaze. After forfeiting, as it forfeited it, as we were about to learn on Christmas 2021, Tomosuku never spoke of it again. As I grew up, the sword came out of the basement less often. In the October 2019, when my partner Nicole and I were visiting Benny, I showed it to her for the first time and noticed the level of detail about the family's origins included on the tag. The idea of finding its owner became impossible to ignore. By then, the world had become less accessible for Benny. He still lived a self-sufficient life in the home he'd built, but he depended on others to drive him places. He had witnessed the death of people he could recall being born. A relationship had already resembled one of friends much closer in age than a relative separated by 60 years, and now it deepened. Physical limitations set in, though he remained sharp mentally and good conversation. Generosity and humor took on a greater roles in his life. Searching for the sword's owner was something Benny and I could do together. Finding someone on planet Earth no longer required going anywhere, so finally we considered a next step. Part 2. Please forgive me if you are rude. Internet in Maumee, Ohio, June 2021 and May 2022. Benny didn't believe that finding the owners of the sword would be possible. I believe it would be straightforward. Neither of us were right. I envisioned a heavily romanticized version of how things would transpire. The fantasy is showing up at the airport with your 99-year-old grandfather, cane in one hand and unconcealed carry-on cantata in the other, and accompanying him in an adjoining seat, like Uma Thurman in her sword in Kill Bill Volume 1. You bring the sword to the small town it came from, going door to door and showing the tag to strangers. Instead, we type the name into a search field, which for a computerless 99-year-old is almost as magical. We started with the information on the tag, name and town. Google got us nowhere. The information we sought, if it was on the internet at all, wasn't searchable in Latin script. Still, we had a name. Takaharu is a small, it's a small town, population 7,900. People in town of that size know one another. Finding someone takes time, and not just your own. The day after I'd asked Benny if he was interested in finding the family, I messaged Yutaka Nakamura, a journalist friend of mine in Tokyo, who I met in 2006 while he was covering baseball in San Francisco. It was June 21st, 2021. He responded on June 22nd. He'd already made some phone calls. That's not just fast, considering the Tokyo-Chicago time difference. It may qualify as time travel. Yutaka's message made it slightly more enjoyable to be stuck in Chicago apartment during the pandemic. Writing in a second language, he used whimsical phrases like searching for clues that lent some buoyancy to what we were doing. In 2021, one settled for internet-based escapades in the hope of realer ones to come. Via Yutaka, we heard back from Takahura town employee that there was no Tomosuku Umeki in the citizen registry, the employee suggesting that our next step be consulting something called a koseki, a family registry. but I need a lawyer to access it. Hiring a lawyer to me to maybe or maybe not obtain information on someone who, statistically speaking, was probably dead seemed like a lateral move. Beyond that, I was informed that it was probably the opposite of legal to bring or ship a sword to Japan, owing to the country's strict weapons law. So we were a week in with zero answers and two legal issues. It did seem that there was a slightly more personal way to go about things. Yutaka suggested that I email the town employee in English and further explain the situation. Perhaps the backstory of the search would trigger a sentiment and compel a proactive response. Proactive meaning the cutting of procedural corners. I wrote that email explaining my intention and asking a stranger for help. I wasn't certain they'd be willing to give in a language I wasn't certain they'd understand. A day went by without a reply, then a week, two. Part of me wanted to be persistent, and part of me wanted to leave Japanese people alone regarding war-adjacent matters I had little understanding of. I thought of plenty of reasons why I didn't get a reply, from language barriers to uncertainty of how this sort of thing might land culturally. When I forwarded the unsuccessful message to Yutaka, asking for his perspective, an idea occurred to him. He said that before we do anything drastic, before we change course, before we start breaking COVID-19 restrictions and knocking on doors, I should do the following. Just send the exact same message to the correct email address. Reply came two days later. Google translates shortcomings on spectacular display. Nice to meet you. My name is Yasuhiro Daigoku. I don't speak English, so I use translation software to write emails. I'm not good at writing letters, so please forgive me if you are rude. The people I worked with in Japan were polite, but this was next level. It seemed that there was a Umeki in Takahiro after all. A nephew of Tomasuku. In my mind, that person was perhaps 12 years old, because regardless of the assuredly advanced age of any nephew of World War II colonel, 12 is the age my imagination conjures for nephews. This nephew apparently didn't have a phone. Good job, parents. Someone listening to any information him would require a visit. Daigaku-san went to the stranger's home, but nobody came to the door. He left and planned to return until a fluke encounter at the Takahura Town Hall expedited things. On unrelated business, the nephew, 92-year-old Kazuaki Umeki, went to Takahura offices. When Daigaku realized who he was, he explained the situation with the Umeki sword. Kazuaki told him that Tomasaku had a son named Takamitsu, living in a place called Nichien. Kazuaki was overwhelmed by the story and gave Daigaku a phone number. We were a phone call away with a nonagenarian count up to three. Daigaku made initial contact. It was Mitsuku Umeki, Takamitsu's wife, who answered the phone. The call was from a man in a town from her family's past, informing her that someone in the United States had something that belonged to her father-in-law, who died in 1974. Her husband wasn't home. She asked for a letter to be sent, and after hanging up, she thought it over, wondering whether things like this really happened, and experienced a peculiar sensation that comes from finding out that someone you don't know has been searching for you. News spread through the family while they waited for the letter. 76 years after Tomasuku wrote the note on the tag, Benny and I responded. Yutaka translated, and we mailed our letters from the U.S. in both English and Japanese, with photos of the sword and the tag. A line in the letter that came directly from my grandfather. He probably wasn't so different from me, only born on the other side of the world. In Japan, the saying Ruku no Koto is used to describe a place that's so close yet so far away, inaccessible despite its proximity. The literal meaning is out-of-the-way place or remote land. In Miyazaki Prefecture, it pertains to the hilly, densely vegetative landscape of the region. The need to travel much farther than a straight line from A to B. Google Translates occasionally spits it out as island of land, which is at once redundant and profound. We waited for the letter to be carried around the world, and for the second time in this story, a chain of postal services delivered. I put my phone down on the kitchen table and told Benny about the email. Yutaka had received a hard copy of a letter from the Umeki family and translated it. I read it to Benny. Tomasuku Umeki had written the first message in 1945. We had written the second nearly 80 years later. And Tomasuku's son, Takamitsu Umeki, had replied with a third. This message began like Tomasuku's had ended. I read a letter from you and appreciate your kindness. He explained that Tomasuku, a colonel in the war, had died in 1974 at the age of 74. Takamitsu, who was 96 years old when he wrote to us, said he remembered the sword from before the war. His father had left home with it, but returned unarmed. My father did not talk about the sword when he came back from the war, Takamitsu wrote, so I believe that the sword was forfeited to the U.S. Army. Takamitsu was surprised to see the state of the gently curving blade in the photos we sent. The gleaming steel, effectively free of rust to a novice inspector, the rolling temper line along the single-edged blade still apparent, perhaps not so different from how it looked to him as a teenager when it went to war on his father's hip. Takamitsu also served in World War II and was 20 when it ended. He had two swords, one given to him by his father. Japan was demilitarized as a condition of This surrender, all swords, even those not used as war weapons, were required to be forfeited to the Allied forces that occupied Japan until 1952. Rather than handing over his after the war, Takemitsu brought them back to Takahura and buried them. When he unearthed the swords 2 or 3 years later, they were completely rusted. He threw them away. The letter described his father returning in November 1945 from Jeju, Korea. This didn't fit neatly into the narrative we pieced together since starting the search. We assumed that Tomosuku had ended the war on Okinawa, or Benny had found the sword. Upon returning his family in Takahura, the colonel, initially prohibited along with his son from holding public office because of his position as an officer in the Imperial Japanese Army, was resigned to a simple, peaceful life farming the rich land of Miyazaki Prefecture. Many former military officers and their families were prohibited from holding political offices under the U.S. occupation of Japan immediately following the war. The Umeki spent the early years of their post-military lives working as father and son. Eventually, Takemitsu started his own family and moved to the coastal town of Nichiyan. The letter ended with gratitude and acceptance of the proposed idea of the sword making its way home. My grandfather was finally hearing the other side. I asked him what he thought. He paused, then went back to 76 years. I'm not the smartest guy, but when I saw the tag, I knew it meant something. There was a story there. It was a touching moment with a level of clarity before things again got complicated. The Omicron coronavirus variant was just getting started, and travel to Japan was prohibited. Finding a person no longer requires going anywhere, but properly returning what's theirs might. We also learned that there wasn't just two sides to the story. There was a third, the swords, and none of us, Takemitsu included, knew anything more about it. When you first think about attempting something like this, your fantasy is simple. The imagination can't be bothered with unromantic minutiae. With weapons laws, consulates, viruses, visa sponsorships, complications of traveling with 99-year-olds, the companionless void of traveling without 99-year-olds, shipping restrictions, and the possibility of finding a cardboard box suitable for shipping an object similar in size to the bones of a fully extended human leg, sword licensing's extremely limited dates on which it's possible to license a sword. I began addressing the logistics of getting the sword and myself into Japan. For me, it was a COVID waiting game. For the sword, I lacked confidence in the two options available, flying with it and sending it ahead to Tokyo. Did I want to show up at American and Japanese airports with a 3-foot sword? Yes, kind of. Being escorted into back rooms for questioning by TSA officials had a curious appeal after so much of the initial work had been carried out on screen. The more people I spoke with who transported swords internationally, the more it became apparently that we both benefit from traveling alone. Assuming that the sword would be allowed back into Japan as an antique art object, it had a frictionless path into the country, the mail. It felt fitting for the sword to make its journey back home on its own, just as it had left. In November 2021, Japan announced that it would resume admitting business travelers from certain countries. Securing an official assignment for the story checked the business box for my entry to Japan, but I still wasn't willing to ship the sword to Japan without first learning more about its history on the off chance it got stuck in licensing limbo or confiscated. I wanted a sword expert to judge it in person before it left. After emailing with Umeki's, I came to understand how the blade's changing of hands in 1945, together with Tomosuku's death, had effectively erased its generational story. Simply giving it back didn't strike me as sufficient. It seemed that we'd be given back less than we'd taken. Our family had contributed to the erasure, so it followed that we should do what we could to restore what was lost. Just as I learned about swords going into Japan, I also began learning about the global subculture born from Japanese swords leaving their homeland after World War II. That subculture had an informed voice in Maumee, Ohio. Mark Jones is a collector and dealer who runs some of the leading U.S. sword shows. He was the first person to remove the Umeki blade from its fitting in at least 77 years. It happened very publicly and without ceremony at the Maumee Antique Mall Hot Dog Cafe, where encased meats can be consumed while encased blades are examined. Jones had inherited a sword his grandfather brought home from World War II, common means of entry to the U.S. sword community. He wanted a better one. He bought a better one. Cycle of buying and selling swords as a means of buying and selling more swords followed. He's trafficked in thousands of blades and has about a dozen in his possession at any time. He kept the one his grandfather returned with, but he'd also let that one go for the right price. That might sound cold, but this is how collectors maintain their hobby. Their love for what they do is greater than that for any one object. My question for Jones were, 1, who made the sword? 2, when? 3, where? 4, can I send it to Japan? Japan's strict policies about personal weaponry stem from being demilitarized by Allied forces immediately after World War II. Those laws have evolved. At the national level, due to regional tensions, this meant that the 1954 formation of the Japan Self-Defense Forces, which included ground, air, and maritime forces, and on an individual level, meant the implementation of the first sword registration system. In June 1946, with limited sword production legalized in 1953, The key distinction for legality was and remains artistic significance. To be licensed without complications, swords entering Japan need to qualify as antique pieces of art by having been handmade at least 100 years ago. More modern blades can be licensed as well if they qualify as art objects. Any reasonably trained eye will know quickly whether a blade qualifies, and Jones said that Tomosuku's did. Evaluating whether it was handmade started with a temper line, the Haman in Japanese, which is outlined running along the blade's cutting edge. Japanese swords have a single cutting edge, like a kitchen knife. That said, it's unlikely you'll find a temper line on a department store knife because those are manufactured and not forged. Jones explained that a unique aspect of Japanese swords is their variable strength in different parts of the blade. This is achieved through a process called differential hardening, which ensures that the metal is harder along the cutting edge and more flexible along the spine. Near the end of the sword making process, the smith applies clay to the length of steel they've been heating, folding, and pounding. Clay insulates the steel from heat. Less insulation results in harder steel, so the smith applies less clay to what will become the cutting edge. They heat the blade to the desired temperature and then plunge it into water. The blade can be submerged in oil instead, but this is more common with mass-produced machine-made blades, Jones said. In water, temperature transfer is quick and violent, causing more crystallization to form on the surface of the steel. This is rougher on the steel and sometimes causes it to fracture. In oil, heat diffuses more slowly, resulting in a moderate hardness, and the process is less likely to damage the sword. For those whose interest in swords is artistic, the reward for risking damage is a harder, more visually appealing blade. The sword is then polished, and the complexities of the temper line, a result of the clay application, are exposed. Each handmade blade has a unique temper line. Some are straight and stay consistent with the edge of the blade. Some are noticeably irregular. If it was oil tempered, it would be more uniform. The line wouldn't have had as much individual feature, said Jones, angling the blade in the light, whereas this one is clear and bright. Answering the question of who made the sword required removing the handle to expose the tang, the steel extension of the blade underneath. Bamboo pegs held the handle in place. Jones tapped them out and the handle popped off smoothly. After forging a sword, a smith inscribed their signature along the tang, except this tang was Mumei, nameless. It could be that it was a sign, but it's not anymore, Jones said. How does the tang lose a signature? Because it's undergone suraji, shortening. It's not uncommon for swords to be shortened to meet the functional needs of the day. Signature or not, Jones confirmed that, yes, the blade was more than 100 years old and qualified as an antique. Its age wasn't surprising given that my grandfather had possessed the sword for nearly 80 years. What was surprising was that Jones estimated the blade to be at least 4 centuries old. The primary way for him to assess this was through its shape. The key characteristic that differentiates sword-making eras, had it been made more recently, it likely wouldn't have had as much curvature. In the late 1500s and early 1600s, katanas became less curved. He speculated that the sword's origins could be traced to either Baizen Province, roughly modern-day Okayama Prefecture between Kobe and Hiroshima, or Mino Province, roughly modern-day Gifu Prefecture north of Nagoya. Then said that there were more qualified people to weigh in on specific geography, sword, school, and smith. I'd be visiting such people in Japan. Before we left, Jones told me that he'd share his evaluation with them. Back in Illinois the next day for the second time in his life, Ben Kazer approached a postal employee with an informally packaged sword and sent it around the world. Thus ended his eight-decade custodianship of the blade. The idea, fanciful or otherwise, had been for my grandfather and me to go to Japan together, but this would be the end of the line for him. He had decided over the winter that he wouldn't be able to do it. I told him that I'd see him on Zoom from Nichan. There was still plenty to resolve before then. Jones had unearthed our most daunting question yet. Define the Umeki family. We had a name and a town. Regarding the origins of sword, we had neither. But there is a man outside Tokyo who does his best to bring those details back to life. Part 3. My Sword Guys, Sword Guys, Sword Guy. Tokyo and Tokorozawa, Japan, June 25th and 26th, 2022. You deconstruct a sword to reconstruct its story. Each time you take it apart, ideally you get a little closer. My first full day in Tokyo, I took the subway to the Ginza neighborhood to pick up the sword at Seikodo, the sword shop to which we sent it to handle licensing. With Japan still closed to most foreign visitors, I was an oddity on the streets of a typically global city. At Seikodo, I met the shop's fourth-generation owner, Hisashi Saito and Robert Hughes, a Kamakura-based sword expert and, at the time, a professor at Toyo University. I connected with Hughes through Jones and corresponded with him before my trip. Hughes had been a part of the sword community in Japan for 4 decades. After making what turned out to be a permanent move from Saskatchewan and starting Keichodo Fine Samurai Art to assist in repatriating and restoring blades, his generosity and connections in the sword world seem limitless. Saito presented me with a blade's newly obtained license, issued by the Ministry of Education, Culture, Sports, Science, and Technology. It was gratifying to have been in Japan for slightly more than 24 hours and already, at least temporarily, be the carrier of a licensed blade. I also felt like an imposter. My friend Yutaka met us there, and surrounded by glass-encased blades and suits of samurai armor, we looked, listened, and posed entry-level questions to the sword experts. Saito tapped out the pegs. He and Hughes quickly placed the blade in the same era Jones had, and speculated on three geographical origins, two of which were mentioned by Jones 6 weeks before. Based on the blade's size and curvature, they agreed without hesitation that it was a mid or late Muromachi period blade, meaning that it was likely made in the 1500s. It's a significant blade, Hughes says. When this is restored, it would be a fine piece to hold in a collection. If polished properly and preserved in wooden storage scabbard called a shirasaya, with the occasional application of lubricant preserving blades from rust called choji oil, a sword like this will outlast all of us and the grandchildren of our grandchildren. There are Japanese swords that have endured since the Heian period, 794 to 1185, without serious damage. As Hughes observed, it's a significant blade. There's a difference between significant and exceptional. The Nihon Bijutsu Token Hozo Kyoko, or Society for the Preservation of Japanese Art Swords, judges quality through a process called Shinza. If a blade is submitted to the Nihon Bijutsu Token Hozo Kyoko, and the society recognizes it as significant, it's then classified according to a hierarchy with four tiers. This differs from licensing. Receiving a sword license in Japan, as I just had, is a matter of law. Papering is a sword through official Shinza is a choice. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this return of a sword to Japan, and we'll continue this at our next week. Thank you. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.